I'm sure we'll have some others come in, but we'll go ahead and get started on our last session of the day, an invited session, and we start with Sayandev Mukherjee, who is at Docomo Labs in Palo Alto. For those of you who don't know, Docomo is a major Japanese cellular service provider, and they have a research lab in Palo Alto. And Sayandev's a very interesting fellow in that he works for an operator. And has all sorts of actual real responsibilities, unlike us academics, to actually do real work. But got really interested in stochastic geometry a few years ago. I met him at a conference and developed an expertise in this subject just in a few months, which I found extraordinary and frankly was quite jealous of. And has since then written some very nice papers as well as a book on applying these to heterogeneous networks. And so we thought it'd be nice for him to come here and give a perspective from industry of why these tools are interesting and useful for wireless networks. So, Sayandev Mukherjee.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. And thank you, François, for inviting me to this, very prestigious workshop where where the list of speakers and attendees actually include those from whose books and papers I have learned what I have learned about point processors. So I was going to say motivational speakers in this country talk about fake it till you make it. So I'm an example of one of those. I'm a guy who has posed as an expert in point processors for so long that I managed to make it to this gathering. Okay, so the only reason why I'm not screaming in terror and backing away from this podium is that, unlike many of the luminaries here, I've actually been working on relatively applied problems in wireless systems. And so there may be something here that, that the attendees, all of whom most likely know a lot more about point processors than I ever will. But these attendees have not worked on wireless communication systems, so there might be something of interest to them here. So with that, thank you for remaining until here, until this time of the day, and thank you for being here for my talk. All right, so now you can say that you've seen it. Okay, this is the Cisco chart that is trotted out at every single wireless, conference that there ever is. Okay, now I myself take extreme exception to the modeling assumptions and the method of estimation of these numbers. So ignore the numbers themselves. Look at the general shape of that curve. That is probably something that can be justified. At any rate, the wireless industry, cynically speaking, has decided to take this as gospel. Okay, simply because it serves all of our needs. My bosses in a very famous and large, network operator can take this to their national, spectrum regulator and say, see, we need more spectrum. Okay, peons like me can approach our bosses and say, see, this is why you need to, you need not to fire me, okay, so that I can continue working on these topics. Okay, it suits everybody. Equipment vendors can make a similar pitch to network operators by saying, see, you need to buy more equipment from us, okay, and so on. And I suppose even the spectrum regulators can approach their ultimate bosses, namely the politicians, and say, see, this is why we need more spectrum to be able to auction off. So, suits everybody. Anyway, the point is that, there are various parties asking for more spectrum. There are people asking for more advanced, receiver architectures and signal processing methods for transmission and so on. But as Jeff has made clear on numerous occasions in various public talks, none of them is as immediately, implementable and as promising as that of mere spectrum reuse. Meaning just, shrink the cells and reuse the same spectrum, much more densely. And so we have smaller cells. Okay, and You know, now they are certainly an effective way, and there are many different proposals to do so. There are micro and pico cells, there are femto cells, relays and remote radio heads, but I won't go into all of these details. The only thing to understand is that, you know, one can't just rip out the existing macrocellular network. Operators have spent collectively several hundreds of billions of dollars worldwide in deploying these things. They're not going to go away. So whatever these small cells are, they're going to be overlaid on top of the existing macrocellular networks. In short, you're getting the existing macro cells plus a new tier of small cells, maybe not completely built out. Perhaps they're going to target the high density areas first. High density of traffic areas first. Anyway, together you get what you call, in the industry call a heterogeneous network or a hetnet. Okay, and this is sort of what it looks like. You know, this would be an example where you have only one small cell per big cell, but you can do much better. You can put say 30, and you know this is what it would look like. There are the previous macro cell now covers only a relatively small area of what it used to cover before. Most of the rest of the traffic is handled by these small cells, simply because they're so much closer to the users than the macro cell. Even though they transmit with lower power than the macro cell, they should be able to achieve higher data rates to the users. That's the feeling. Right? So, again, it's feasible, robust, and it's relatively cheap. A dense network of small cells overlaid on the existing macro cell network. Okay, so the question is, how do you design this good headnet? In fact, how do you even define what a good headnet is? So good, you know, is a pretty complicated story here. Because operators have to wrestle with some demanding laws of economics as well. So the good, you know, is a somewhat fuzzy idea. It's a chosen set of operational parameters representing a desirable trade-off between coverage, capacity, and cost. Okay, and cost in this sense means cost not only of deployment, but also of operation. Now, those big macro cells are very expensive to deploy. They are also somewhat expensive to maintain. But at some density, probably, even though the cost of deployment of each individual small cell, picocell or microcell may be small, the overall cost of deployment plus operational expenses might approach or even surpass that of the macrocellular network. So if it does so, it had better be worth it. Coverage and capacity both depend on the distribution of signal to interference plus noise. Now, I thank the numerous speakers before me who have emphasized this connection, which is a bedrock principle in communication systems, not only wireless. So I won't belabor the point. So basically, before we can design the heterogeneous network, the HETnet, we need to understand the behavior of the SINR. Okay, so suppose we're considering a picocell overlay on the existing macrocellular network. How does the distribution at an arbitrarily located user, so we'll call it the typical user, depend on, for example, all of these operational parameters that you would have of the deployment? Okay, up until about 5 years ago, there was no answer to this except to say simulate. Right? Simulation has some benefits. Yeah, sure, you can study any scenario at any desired depth of detail. But obviously, it's time-consuming to even write a working simulator. It requires a separate simulation for every scenario, right? And you don't know what you've missed. Any insights it gives are at best qualitative, not quantitative. Further, the number of combinations of deployment parameters rises exponentially in the number of tiers of the HETnet. So very soon, the size of your simulation problem scales up to be so large that you either need to substantially increase the number of people assigned to be doing this, substantially increase the hardware on which you're going to do the simulation, or, you know, look for other solutions. So that's where I think stochastic geometry-based approaches have their selling point. Basically, Now, they don't model any given scenario to arbitrary detail the way simulation scenarios can. However, they do scale to arbitrary numbers of tiers, and it really doesn't matter what you've got going on in there. They give overall insights without misinterpreting or being biased by any specific scenario, right? Namely, the shrinking small and shrinking subset of scenarios that you were able to simulate. They cannot model detailed aspects. And for exact performance results, something that will pass muster in the standards body, you probably still need the simulation. However, you could use these insights to shrink the search space. You can substantially reduce the number of possibilities over which you need to perform more detailed simulations simply because you can tell at a glance that these are not going anywhere. Okay, and once you're done with that, on that reduced subset of possibilities, simulate away. All right. Fortunately, I do not need to belabor this point. You all know what SINR is at this point. It is the received signal power from the intended transmitter. All other transmitters are treated as interference. Right? And there may be a thermal noise term. There may not be. In this talk, I shall be very careless about saying SINR when often I mean SIR. Simply because it simplifies some of the expressions. Okay, so what's interesting is when you've got a bunch of transmitters, okay, N of them, so these are sort of candidate transmitters. These are the ones from which you want to calculate a joint distribution, perhaps. So that's your SINR when receiving from the kth one out of those. You have a joint SINR exceedance event that can be formulated in this fashion, or an SINR and a power exceedance event, namely the SINR from one of them exceeds something, and the other powers are in this sort of relationship to one another. I will show you examples where we run into these calculations and what we can do with them. But the interesting thing is that they have this property. You've got a matrix A times this vector of received powers exceeding something, some column vector, right? Which happens to be that total interference Z times something, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Now, the interesting thing about A, the square matrix A, is that the off-diagonal entries are non-positive. In this case, they're, so they're either zero or negative. Okay, and so let's take a step back and abstract. All right, so we want to look at, we want to consider the event that N non-negative random variables, x1 through xn, satisfy this sort of relationship, right, where A is square. All off-diagonal entries in A are non-positive. It seems such a matrix is called a Z matrix. We also assume A is non-singular. And, we will make use of this definition in just a moment. An M matrix is one whose inverse has all non-negative entries. Okay? So, let's look at the structure of that thing. Now, it turns out that this... Right, is entirely outside the positive orthant if M is not an M matrix, if A is not an M matrix, and if A is, then it has this kind of structure. Okay, so it's a cone where, generated by the columns, and then there's this displacement. So the vertex is moved away from the origin to that point. So what does this mean? In our context, suppose X is received powers, so since they cannot be negative, it means that if A is not an M matrix, then the probability of that event is in fact zero. And if A is an M matrix, then it has to be the probability as calculated over this conical region. So now it turns out that if these X's, these received powers, happen to have Erlang gamma distribution, then this probability of that event, of this event, over that conical region can be calculated in closed form. Okay? I won't exactly say closed form. It is closed form for exponential, not quite that for this case because we have to do this. But it is obtained in analytic form. The key thing is that you get this term, which is a Laplace transform of Z. Okay? So, in short, okay, well, let's just, take a one parting shot at this. Remember that we do need to be able to tell when A is an M matrix. And it turns out that there is a condition to take care of that, too. Every leading principal minor has to be positive. And as we will see for our examples, they're actually particularly simple. The sequence of leading minors is actually decreasing. And therefore, only the last one need to be considered, which is the determinant of A. So, in short, if the determinant of A is positive, we can calculate something analytically. If it's negative, then that probability is zero. So, quite neat. And so, what do we need for analytical modeling? We need basically to be able to calculate this Laplace transform of Z. Right? So, we need to be able to calculate it analytically, hopefully in closed form if we can. Right? And, of course, we don't want a completely ideal, abstract, placement model that has no relation to reality. So we need something that is applicable to real-world network deployments. Okay, so what can we do? In the wireless world, it has been the norm to deal with this ideal hexagonal lattice. Simply because, I suppose it is it does tile the plane. It looks a little more realistic than squares. Circles leave gaps. They don't tile the plane. So, why not? Right? Later on, it was, it does conform to beams. So we have sectored beams on our base stations, typically 120-degree sectors. And you can play various tricks with sectors in order to illuminate the corners of these presumed ideal hexagonal cells and so on. But in fact, this has very dubious applicability to the real world. Look at any real world network deployment. It looks very far from being this kind of regular lattice. If nothing else, there are geographical features. There are rights of way to be negotiated. There are townships that won't allow an eyesore of a cellular tower to be put up there, and so on. So the real picture is very distorted, very far from this. Okay. Anyway, you can't compute the Laplace transform of interference analytically in this case, and the same holds for most other finite regular deployments. What you can do, however, is look at it asymptotically, and I have bolded the names of the authors of these papers because they are here in the audience. So, which is to say, I absolve myself from all responsibility if I'm completely misinterpreting what they said. Just ask them directly. Okay. All right. So, what I believe Bartek, Mohammed, and Paul have shown is that for any arbitrary layout of a tier of base stations and with log normal fading, okay, so that log normal part was important for the initial result. If the area average number of base stations is finite, the standard deviation is large enough, the point process resembles that you get as if the base stations were placed at the points of a Poisson point process. Okay, and this holds regardless of the path link loss model, so which is very nice. It was generalized quickly to IID Suzuki fading, and then further generalized by Paul and his collaborators in Melbourne to arbitrary IID fading that satisfies certain general and pretty mild assumptions. So now these are all asymptotic results, but they certainly show that the Poisson point process seems to play an important part here. So there seems to be a kind of a fundamental law, something like the central limit theorem, that drives these networks to behave as if they were Poisson asymptotically. So, and in fact, what happens in real life? Now, I actually haven't shown the real life result. That's somewhere in the middle between these two. It's hemmed in by the hexagonal lattice and by the PPP. Okay. Now Martin will show you tomorrow, how the PPP can be made to do better. But the key thing is that Now, we can obtain insights into the behavior of a practical deployment, maybe by a combination of these two curves, or perhaps by the Poisson point processes alone. Okay, so with that said, I think I've made the case, I believe, that one can use Poisson point processes to study wireless networks. In fact, I think in a gathering such as this, you know, very unlike a wireless industry gathering where people would argue in favor of the hexagonal lattice, here anybody who disagrees with my choice of the PPP is probably because they're favoring the DPP or a permanental point process. So, all right, so let's look at link loss and, you know, just define what it is, basically. There's a link loss on the link between some base station B and some user, you know, and it's a typical user. I'm going to locate that user at the origin. So we have this where alpha is the path loss exponent bigger than 2. K is the intercept of the slope-intercept path loss model. You know, it's just called slope-intercept because if you plot this on the log scale, it becomes a line. That K in dBs would be the slope, and you know, alpha in would be the intercept, and this alpha in dBs would be the slope. Okay. So, and the received power is basically the same thing inverted and then multiplied by the transmit power, right? So, just to establish notation, now there's a lot of talk here, but this is the main result, and this is exactly what Bartek already showed. The link loss point process has the same intensity function as the path loss, that is, no fading point process, from a different homogeneous PPP located tier of base stations, whose density is basically that of the original tier times the moment of the fading coefficient. Right? So, of course, we do require the fading coefficient has to have a finite moment. But this is what happens. Just lambda changes to lambda times that thing. Okay, and so what about the set of received powers? Ah, now this is a bit more complicated. You know, and you could formally apply the mapping theorem. You know, it's a PPP, so apply to the inverse. That's my, you know, that's my intensity measure. But is it really? You know, Martin pointed this out to me that it isn't. Look at this. This becomes infinite for all positive y. Okay, even though it is finite for all compact k that doesn't include the point zero. So this is a bit annoying. Fortunately, we can get around it. If you include this concentration point zero with the rest of the PPP restricted to the open positive real line, then you know, it's called a Poisson random set. It has the same capacity functional, and since received power is never zero, basically we can identify the set of received powers with the PPP on that with that intensity measure. Now, when you've got that intensity measure, which is, you know, this defines a, the subordinator whose Levy measure is this, allows you to derive this beautiful result, which is just a preview of something that Bartek is going to show you tomorrow. I don't want to rain on his parade. Okay, so we've answered some pretty important questions here. Let's look at cell association. All right. So what happens in LTE? All base stations transmit reference symbols, right? And a user terminal aggregates multiple measurements of the received reference symbols and then smooths out the fast fading, right? And then, you know, basically on this basis, assuming, say, the fast fading has been completely eliminated, all you're left with is the slow or shadow or log normal fading, different terms for the same thing. You know, you choose something on the basis of something that in the wireless industry is called reference symbol received quality. It's actually the STIR. Remember the T? That is the total interference. Namely, in the denominator, you add not only the interference from all non-transmitting base stations, but also from the transmitter. Okay, so if we assume residual fading is slow only, the IID and IID across all links to the user, well, then, you know, as we've seen, this base station deployment is equivalent to another one that is without fading, right? And that has an adjusted density. So the n strongest base stations in the original deployment become the n nearest base stations in the new one. And so we have other strategies where you have multiple transmissions, simultaneous transmissions from multiple base stations. It's called coordinated multipoint, and it's a major technology in wireless. Basically you can just select the N strongest base stations or original deployment, that's to say they become the N nearest base stations in the new one, and so on. So all problem formulations involving those cell associations can be translated into cell associations in terms of Euclidean distance only in this new equivalent point process. Also, homogeneous Poisson point process of the base stations. Across tiers of a heterogeneous network, since the network operators have spent all this money building out this small cell tier, they want to put users on it and get them off the macro tier, which is more expensive for a user to be on. So they try to fool the user's handsets into thinking that these small cell tiers are more powerful than they are. And that's done by means of tier selection bias factors. We will go into that in just a moment. They can easily be handled. They are handled in terms of the SINR and power exceedance levels, which I showed you an example earlier, but we'll see that very soon. Okay, so that was cell association. Now you have coverage. Right, so the cell, your user is associated with some base station like that. Now you've got coverage, where again, you don't want to take into account the momentary fast fading effects when you do coverage probability calculations. So what would be the coverage probability? So the user, it's probably that the RSRQ exceeds some threshold. Okay. Now it turns out, and this is again a consequence of the two-parameter Poisson-Dirichlet result, and again I won't go into the details, but the joint distribution of the top n ordered RSRQs is available and can be used to perform calculations to solve, to answer many important questions about coverage probabilities. Note that this coverage is in terms of received STIR of the reference symbols, not the data symbols. So it's actually that the user can maintain radio contact with the selected serving base stations. Doesn't say much about the bit rate of actual data traffic. So we'll go into that next. Okay, that's the instantaneous data SINR. So let's consider an arbitrarily located user, typical user. Data SINR. Now what happens? Let's deal with the equivalent topology, where the base stations, had no fast fades and no shadow fades, actually no fades at all from the point of view of cell association calculations. But now that you are associated with your nearest transmitting base station, and that base station actually transmits to you, that transmission obviously is subject to fading. Right, so you're going to have to take into account, fast fades when this happens. So now you have to take into account the distribution of SINR accounting for fast fading. This is a somewhat contrived example. I will show you more serious examples very shortly. So the candidate serving base station in each tier is the single nearest one. And I want to see what's the, distribution of the instantaneous strongest SINR out of these N candidate serving base stations. Right? You'd calculate it like this, using the inclusion-exclusion formula. And voila, here it is. There's an SINR exceedance event, and we know how to write this out in terms of that matrix vector formulation and calculate that analytically. Right? So at this point, I just wanted to consolidate what we've learned so far. All right? The SINR exceedance event can be expressed in this form. We know that if these are independent and X1 through XN are Erlang, then this probability can be calculated in closed form. Well, what I'm calling closed form is not really. For A, a Z matrix, and all positive B, obviously. If A is an M matrix, and if A is not, then this probability is zero. And, of course, the Laplace transform of Z has to be available analytically. Right? What we shall see is that this can be calculated when the base stations are modeled by PPPs, not when they're placed on the regular hexagonal lattice. Of course, the PPP model yields conservative results because there's no lower limit upon the distance for, between the transmitter and the nearest interferer. Okay, so let's look at the single tier and let's focus on calculating this Laplace transform of Z. Right, it's pretty easy. You get it direct from the probability generating functional, and this is what you have. Right, so when H is Rayleigh, for example, when you have Rayleigh fading, H is exponential, and that makes it especially easy. So let's look at that. This is a joint distribution of SIR from many tiers. We have the candidate serving base stations are the nearest ones, right? So conditioned on the distances to these nearest ones, one in each tier, the received power from the candidate serving base station in tier K, exponential like that, with that mean, and this is what we want. It can be written like that. We know how to calculate it. It looks like this. A takes this form. You can write it out in closed form like that. Very neat. And A inverse can therefore be calculated easily using the Woodbury formula. And here's our Laplace transform, and there's the 2F1 function again. Okay, I wrote a slightly different version of that because I like this last argument to be positive and less than 1, if possible. Simplifies the numerical calculation. Okay, with a single tier and that X1 being Erlang gamma instead of just exponential, we know what we have to do. This is what it is. But in fact, there was a rather clever derivation done recently where they managed to write this out in this nice form as an L1 norm, basically, of a certain lower triangular triplets matrix. But I won't go into details on this point. You're welcome to read the literature. Okay, here's another example. You have tier selection biases, right? So you've got etc. It's served by the nearest one. Now you multiply each one by this tier selection bias tau sub I, and then choose the strongest one, right? So basically, what happens? Distribution of the SINR now takes this form, which is an SINR and power exceedance event, and so you can write it like that, right? Again, I've shown you an example how that looks. It looks like that, which you can calculate again. A is a little more complicated, but it's still pretty simple. And again, the inverse of A can be obtained in closed form. Here it is. And recall that the probability is zero if determinant is negative. And, this is merely another way of, restating this, the same results that Bartek showed, namely that P sub K, the exceedance probability of the K coverage event, becomes zero past a certain point. From PPP theory, the Laplace transform Z is this, and therefore, once more, you can just stick it in there and get the result. Right? Okay, so how about comp? So you've got now the transmitters are the m nearest base stations. Okay, what I say here applies to a particular form of comp called interference alignment. It ensures a d-dimensional channel that is free of in-cluster interference, namely these m don't interfere with one another, which is obviously desirable. And all interference is from base stations that are farther away than the m-th closest one. Right? So, conditioned on all these distances, the received power again happens to be exponential, of course, really fading everywhere. And the distribution of SIR can again be calculated that way, and there you go. Okay, so here's another one, right? So in this one, let's not look at the nearest base station necessarily, but let's say what happens when you have the ability to instantaneously switch to the strongest base station, right? So this is the best SIR or SINR you can actually get in this system. So what happens? Well, for a single-tier deployment, obviously, you have the two-parameter Poisson-Dirichlet, and you're sort of redoing the calculations for the coverage probability, Okay, but for more than one tier, this the distribution of maximum instantaneous SINR, you can write it like that, and again expand it in terms of the inclusion-exclusion formula, and then you get results. You have to calculate a probability like that, or rather, as I've written it, the summation of a probability like that. Okay, and it turns out that you can calculate these by means of the Slivniak-Meket theorem. Again, I won't go into the details. However, after some manipulation, it finally works out to be like this. And look here. Here we have a similar type of expression again. Okay, where this time W is the sum total power at the user, right, from all transmitters. So, we know that that is zero if that determinant is negative, and that determinant is like this, which is pretty easy. It's positive for only finitely many of these of those terms in that summation, and therefore, you can simplify the result. I won't go into that, but suppose all the path loss exponents from all the tiers to the user are the same, and suppose that my threshold is positive, then in fact you can show that this is greater than zero only for one term, exactly as Bartik showed. This is just a different way of showing the same result. And we obtain the very well-known result that Harpreet, Jeff, et al. Showed. Here it is. And if you don't restrict gamma to be bigger than 1, but, n satisfies that relationship, again, refer to Bartik's talk, we can write this out like this. Okay, and so it's a sum of terms. Well, at least the first two here can be obtained in, well, what may as well be called closed form. Okay, and there's a new 2F1 function again. More than that, I wasn't able to get anything in closed form. I think you have to use the I and J functions that Bartik defined and calculate them numerically. Okay, so one final example. What's the coverage probability in a multi-tier hetnet? So now we're not doing instantaneous SINR, but coverage probability. Very similar, right? So, it's maximum SIR. And as Bartik already explained, we can do this trick where we assume now that that the system is not fade-free, but has really fading, just so we can use the properties of the exponential distribution here for this calculation. So then this calculation becomes pretty much the same as before, only we have tier-dependent thresholds, right? One for each tier. So there's some more notational complexity, of course, but then finally you get the full form of the result that Harpreet and Jeff showed 3 years ago now. And so what actually happens is that the probability that the serving tier is the kth one happens to be this sort of selection probability in this equivalent superposed Poisson point process. Okay, and what about non-Erlang distributed powers or fades? Much harder. We don't really have a good result. But I think an engineering approximation can be made. We can approximate pretty nearly any PDF by, uniformly using an infinite mixture. Obviously, the trick is to find the right finite mixture that gets close. Some people have actually labored in that direction and provided some useful results, but we actually haven't explored that much. Okay, so what about data rates? Once you've got these, once you've got the instantaneous, SINR, well, you can do data rates, right? So the mean achievable data rate to the user is that, and when you use Shannon's formula, you can calculate it like that. However, and, this is the more important message here, this is a measure of the service quality as experienced by the user. Remember, we've been calculating all SINR distributions at a typical user, that is to say, arbitrarily located user. So if I am a subscriber to somebody's network, right, this is really what I'm interested in. among other things. Of course, I might be interested in the overall distribution, but at least the mean is what I want to know. Right? So this is what I can expect to get in this network. However, this isn't exactly what the network operator is particularly bothered about. The network operator wants to brag about, you know, the sort of area average throughput that they can provide to all the users throughout their network. Right? So they are looking at something else. They really, I would say, are interested in the mean achievable total throughput to all users, and I think the right entity here is the typical cell. Okay, now, the user, you know, when we focus upon an individual user, that user, say, we plop that user at the origin, the cell that contains that user is now the zero or Crofton cell. Now, that is bigger than the typical cell. So we've got some complications here. Of course, you know, Bartek and Mohammed have done some magical calculations, you know, where they are able to calculate probabilities over the typical cell in terms of the, you know, overall stationary probabilities. But I wasn't able to do that here. If we make certain simplifying assumptions, the total throughput to users in the typical cell becomes the throughput to a single user whose location is uniformly distributed over the typical cell. Problem is, we don't know this. What we were able to do is simulate, and, you know, over a pretty wide range of user to base station densities, where both are assumed independent PPPs, we got a pretty fine match by simply modifying that distribution of distance to be Rayleigh with a slightly adjusted density. In fact, 25% higher. We really don't know how this works, but this is probably the right mix of experts here to answer this question. But if anybody has any suggestions, please do talk to me. And so what this allows us to do is to continue using the previously derived formulas. We just make the modification of density, right? So one final slide. Is this, so we have our, data rate, but is that also the ergodic rate? I venture to say no. By our definition, right, we take an instantaneous snapshot of the system. That gamma is the instantaneous SINR. The ergodic rate, by definition, makes radically different assumptions. I can't really, equate these assumptions to those under which we'd made this calculation. But again, I would love to be corrected on this. So for the ergodic rate, when we want to average over all states of the channel to the user, we run into more problems. The baseband equivalent complex total interference signal is not Gaussian. And so we can't even really apply the Shannon formula. However, Lapidoth and Shammai did show, using a codebook and decoder designed for Gaussian noise, the spectral efficiency behaves as if the interference were Gaussian. So if that is the case, then as, Angel Lozano and his students and postdocs have calculated, we may use this formula for ergodic rate by approximating the interference by additive white Gaussian noise with the same covariance matrix, and then probably their simulations show that this is a pretty good approximation. Again, I would welcome more discussion on this, because I am unsure of the depth of my own understanding of this subject. Okay, so conclusions. The number and variety of deployment scenarios for HetNet's too great for detailed simulation study. So we propose stochastic geometric approaches. PPP seems to be good, mathematically tractable, yields important insights, closed form results sometimes obtainable. Compared to classical results, it yields conservative results, which is actually a good thing. We don't want to be too conservative, because the network operators do not want to overbuild, but it is conservative enough to give us credibility, I believe, with network operators. And the zero cell versus typical cell calculations are wonderful, because what would be an otherwise esoteric argument translates directly into two different perspectives on the user quality experience. And this is really more of a preview of what Martin is going to show you tomorrow. Substantial additional approximate results are available by relaxing certain assumptions, but I'll leave it at that point. Thank you very much.
Any time for one question?
Yeah, just a remark about your slide of endorsements is not Gaussian.
Uh-huh.
We made the work when we show the case of Gaussian endorsements is the worst case.
I see.
Among all these solutions.
Okay.
So this is a good bar.
Ah, I see. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think since we're running behind it anyway, we're getting to the end of the day. I'll go ahead and we'll bring up our final speaker of the day. Before we go ahead and get to my